Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on this February 12, the birthday of Abraham Lincoln. This hour, we're going to be getting a preview of the State of the Union address, and we also are delighted to have the historian for the U.S. Senate with us who will give us information about how presidents from George Washington onward have dealt with what Congress has called for just from time to time, the president addressing issues that he is concerned about. And some have delivered in person, some have sent messages. Have any of them been controversial? Have any of them made a big splash? Our guest, the historian of the Senate, Donald Ritchie, says that the founding fathers would be pleased to see what's happened with the State of the Union and astonished to see that we have a congressional record. Later in the hour, Reed Epstein will join us, White House political reporter for Politico, and he's written an interesting column of five things that we should all be watching for and listening for tonight when the president gives his address. Donald Ritchie is the historian of the U.S. Senate. He has a Ph.D. in history from the University of Maryland and joined the Senate Historical Office in 1976. What a great job, isn't it? He's the author of a number of books, including Press Gallery, Congress, and the Washington Correspondence, Our Constitution, and the U.S. Congress, A Very Short Introduction. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. As we always do, the number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Donald Ritchie, hello.
Good morning.
You have a great job. I saw a little video of you yesterday, and you were so good. I thought, oh, Donald has a wonderful job.
Well, I tell people I have a front row seat for the best show in town.
Yes, you do. What does the Constitution say? Does it say formally that the president needs to go before Congress and deliver in person a speech every year, or is it more vague?
Now, our Constitution is a very short document, and it leaves lots to be imagined, essentially, by those who will follow. But it does want some transparency in government. So it tells the president that from time to time, the president must give Congress a message on the State of the Union and make recommendations about what needs to be done. And some presidents, starting with George Washington and John Adams, came up in person to make a delivery of these speeches. And then starting with Thomas Jefferson, who didn't like to speak in public, the presidents began sending up the messages. And so some clerk of the Senate or the clerk of the House would read it out. Tend to be very long and very dry speeches, probably not much of an audience. And then in 1913, Woodrow Wilson, who had trained as a political scientist, realized it was a missed opportunity for the president not to go in person. And so he started the modern tradition of presidents going up essentially once a year, although not necessarily because it just says from time to time, but to deliver that speech in person, to lay out a legislative agenda for the Congress.
Mm-hmm. Herbert Hoover also was not a very good speaker, so he decided to send a message as well. Is that right?
Yes, Hoover never really appreciated Congress, I think. He thought he could do as much as possible without it, and he was not a good speaker, and so he chose just to send his messages up.
And when you talk about Washington, and I'm wondering how long this goes in U.S. history, he gave recommendations, and then there were, this is interesting, ad hoc committees that would address each of the issues.
Right. In those days, there were no standing committees of the Senate and the House. And so when the president laid out an agenda of, you know, what the big issues were, Washington didn't recommend what they do about them, but just basically said you need to address these issues. And so what they would do is take the message and sort of cut it apart paragraph by paragraph and appoint an ad hoc committee to decide whether or not they would indeed have some legislation relating to that. And once the committee came up with its recommendation, then that committee would go out of existence and Congress would either pass or ignore the issue that the president had brought up. Nowadays, as well, at least since 1816, we've had standing committees of Congress, and so they each one has a jurisdiction. And when the president mentions an issue like gun control or whatever the other issues might be, there are committees that are designated to deal with those issues.
Because it is his birthday today, what did Abraham Lincoln do?
Oh, Lincoln sent up his messages, which is too bad.
It was
interesting to hear what he would have had to have said if he appeared in person. We do know, by the way, that when presidents have delivered their speeches in person, they tended to be a lot shorter than the messages they sent up. The Lincolns were, like all the other presidents, were relatively long laundry lists. They included budget issues as well as other issues that we're dealing with. But Lincoln's State of the Union messages don't get carved on the walls of his memorial.
You say that usually they're not very exciting. Have there been times when they've been particularly poetic or they have called for dramatic action?
Oh, yes. The presidents have recognized the importance of these events, and because this is inherently a dramatic moment when the House and the Senate and the Cabinet and the Supreme Court, the Diplomatic Corps and the press galleries are full. Everybody is there waiting to hear what the president has to say. And so presidents often will make dramatic proposals in their speeches, giving some sense of what kind of motion they want. And some of them are very memorable speeches, like Franklin Roosevelt talking about the Four Freedoms, or Lyndon Johnson proposing a great society in his speech. One of the most dramatic moments that I remember was in 1999. The Senate was in the middle of an impeachment trial of President Clinton. And everybody wondered whether or not Clinton would just send up his message, or would he dare to come to the Capitol, to go to the House chamber where he'd been impeached, and face this audience of people who were actually deciding the fate of his presidency. And he came up as if nothing else was going on and delivered a speech quite remarkably. I think just shocked everybody that he was able to fully function given the circumstances.
When did we start broadcasting speeches? I assume it was radio and then television. When did that happen?
That's right. President Coolidge's State of the Union message was broadcast in 1923. There had been an attempt to do one of President Harding's, but it was a very limited radio broadcast. But Coolidge's was the first to be broadcast on the radio. And then Harry Truman's in 1947 was the first on television.
And now, what is the policy with the networks? Are they asked to carry this? Do they feel it an obligation? Do all of the networks carry this now?
The government can't order the networks to carry anything, but it certainly makes it accessible to them. And it's been a tradition that the major networks all carry the State of the Union message. In addition, these days, it's streamed over the Internet as well. So it has quite an international audience. And, of course, some of the speech deals with foreign policy issues. And so it has an audience of people who are very concerned about what the president has in mind.
And how soon before the address, Donald, do members of the press get a copy of it?
Usually everybody gets a copy sort of earlier in the day. And that's way so that members of the press can make little comments about what to look for and expect at that stage. The White House sometimes is working on that speech right up until the day of the State of the Union. And in fact, what usually happens is the speech is much longer and then gets cut down so that somebody can deliver it within basically an hour's time. And so some things wind up on the cutting room floor. But usually, within a few hours or so before the speech, the members of the press will know what at least the broad outlines, if not the specifics, are.
And in the television age, who has been particularly long-winded, and who has been succinct?
Well, they all run about an hour or so, and half of that time seems to be taken up with prolonged applause. You know, there's a lot of cheering by the president's party. President Clinton managed to be relatively brief, although he tended to be the longest speaker in the group. President Reagan was very skilled at these events. He's the one who introduces having the guests in the audience, the heroes and the people who are there to promote some part of his issue. You know, he had been a Hollywood actor, and he understood the importance of props, and he also understood the importance of ceremony and spectacle. And his State of the Union messages were, sort of really the model, I think, that other presidents have followed. But they've all been about the same length in recent times. They're thinking about the television audience, I think the amount of time that would take.
I think we all expect now, we're looking to see who they've brought as special guests, aren't we? And I didn't know that Reagan had started that.
In 1982, it was a fellow named Lenny Skutnik who had jumped into the Potomac River, which was frozen over, to rescue passengers from the Air Florida flight.
Oh, yes, I remember that. Oh, interesting. And all of the, this hasn't happened, I wonder how long it's been, but all of the addresses used to be published, the whole address in the newspaper?
That's right. Back in the 19th century, the newspapers used to spend a lot of time printing not only presidents' messages in full, but the speeches of members of Congress. These days, most are lucky to get a soundbite, you know, but we devoted a lot more page length to the to speeches. And the New York Times continued, I'm not sure if it still does, they like to think of itself as the paper of record, and whenever a president gave a speech to Congress, they would print the entire text in that speech. Because there are other ways. You can go to the White House website, you can go to all sorts of places to get the full text, or watch it on YouTube, and you know, there's lots of ways in which members can get access to it as well as reading it in the papers.
And as you have said, the Founding Fathers would have been astonished and, should we say, delighted to see we have a congressional record?
Right. People sometimes think the congressional record is required by the Constitution, but it just says essentially from time to time Congress needs to publish a journal of its proceedings. And they continue to do that. It's essentially an outline of what happens. But because newspaper reporters came onto the floor of the House and the Senate right from the very beginning and began trying to write down the speeches, eventually those were compiled by the papers and published, and that grew into what we now know as the congressional record. So everything that the president says while he's here and everything that every member of Congress says during the day will appear the very next day in the congressional record. And I think that's a feat that would astonish the authors of the Constitution.
Even though it tends to be a partisan affair with, if depending on what party you're with, the opposite party sits or they stand and applaud, sometimes wildly, it's usually a fairly polite affair, but that hasn't always been the case. We're reminded of when President Obama was booed.
That's right. And someone shouted out, and one of the members shouted out during his speech, and that member was censured for doing
mm-hmm.
that. And it's happened before. President Bush was booed at times, and if you go to any parliament, if you sit in the British Parliament, the members are constantly heckling each other, especially
right.
the Prime Minister is while he's speaking. But the U.S. Congress has always had a tradition of respectfully listening, and they're particularly when the President comes. And that's a tradition that they tried very hard to maintain.
We welcome phone calls. If you'd like to join our conversation, Donald Ritchie is our guest. He is the historian for the United States Senate, and he's giving us a history of the State of the Union address so we can be fully informed before we watch the president and listen to the president. We will, of course, be carrying the State of the Union address at 8 o'clock tonight here on the Ideas Network and the Republican response, which will follow from Marco Rubio. We'll have to ask Donald about response from the opposite party to the State of the Union. When did that start? Our phone number for you to join the conversation, perhaps you remember some outstanding State of the Union addresses that had terrific ideas that Congress either acted on or did not. But it essentially, as our guest says, is a chance for the president to present his, we've never had a her, wish list. What would be the accomplishments that if he had his way, they would all become some kind of reality, perhaps in the next year. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. The Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. In a little while, we'll have a guest with us from Politico who's written a piece on five things that we ought to look for in the speech this evening. Actually, the police officer from Oak Creek who was wounded in the horrendous Sikh shooting last summer will be one of the guests tonight in the gallery. So that's interesting. To you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now and start with Greg in Milwaukee. Hi, Greg.
Hi. My question is, which president gave the longest State of the Union, the shortest State of the Union address? And is this the first time that we've had two responses to the State of the Union? I'll take my answers off the air.
Thanks, Greg.
The shortest, I think, was given by President Washington. The longest were probably 19th century presidents who sent up those messages. Those are very long, thick messages, not to be read aloud, or they were read by clerks, and they took quite some time. The issue about responses started in the 1960s when they decided to give some time to Republicans to respond to President Lyndon Johnson, and Everett Dirksen and Gerald Ford gave the first response. And over time, the out party has experimented with sometimes single speakers, sometimes multiple speakers, and so you've got lots of different approaches to this. This year, Senator Rubio is giving the primary response from the Republican Party, but that's it's a sense of trying to create some balance for the two parties, since the president, of course, will be promoting his party's agenda.
Who gets to seat in the public area, Donald?
Well, every member of Congress gets a ticket, and so that ticket will go to a spouse or a staff person or a constituent or somebody who is really desperate, is in town, would really love to go there. But there's very little space actually in the chamber for extra guests. People stand in the back. It is literally packed in there. So more people see it definitely on the television than get to get into the room.
Mm-hmm. Jake is next in Black River Falls. Hi, Jake.
Hi. I got two questions. Has the president ever refused to do the State of the Union address? And my second question is it mandatory for all congressional delegates to be there? I personally think the State of the Union, in all fairness, is just a waste of time. Because, once the out party gives their response, and like this president here, he's not trying to build any bipartisanship. So I just personally think it's a waste of time.
All right.
Well, the answer to the question about whether or not presidents can refuse to do it is yes, they can decline. The Constitution only says from time to time, not every year. And a lot of times when presidents are coming into office, they haven't worked out an agenda yet. So they'll give a speech on a particular subject, but it's really not a State of the Union speech. And sometimes when presidents are leaving office, especially if they've been defeated for re-election, they choose not to give an outgoing State of the Union message. So we have had some years in which the incoming or outgoing president has not given a State of the Union message. As to whether or not it's mandatory, it's not mandatory for members of Congress to attend. Most of them do. It's a very dramatic moment. They like to be there and be caught up in it. They like to make responses to their TV stations from their home states, and they also now are texting and tweeting while the speech is going on. So it's an important moment, but quite a few members don't go for various reasons, especially some of the older members often choose not to attend the State of the Union. But as to whether or not it's a waste of time, a lot of the legislation that will come out during this Congress will be discussed in the State of the Union message. It may not be exactly what the president asks for, but the outlines of the issues that the president and the president's party are going to fight for are going to be there. And so it's important for everybody to know what those issues are, what priorities are being given by this administration. Of course, it's up to Congress as a separate branch to respond to that.
I think it's a very important speech, actually.
It's one of the most important speeches that a president gives. State of the Union is like the inaugural address, because it's one of those very few times when everyone is together on an issue. Usually the inaugural address is sort of more high-flowing, more rhetorical, and the State of the Union is a little bit more down-to-earth. This is what we need to do.
Right. And speaking of texting, here's an email from Mike in Prairie du Chien. I've noticed a trend of members of Congress using instant messaging during this speech. I think it's rude. It's akin to using your cell phone during a movie or at church.
Well, the House of Representatives changed its rules in this Congress to allow members to use electronic devices on the floor. The Senate still prohibits it. Senators are supposed to step into the cloakrooms if they want to text or to use a cell phone or anything. But House members are a little freer to do this. And, of course, when the senators go to the House chamber, they're working under the House rules. They members of Congress love to communicate, and they have communicated on every possible means of the technology available. The very first telegraph message was sent from the Capitol building to Baltimore. It was, "What hath God wrought?" And the message that came back from Baltimore was, "What's the news from Washington?" And so members of Congress really adjust to whatever is the latest trend in communications. And so they are all texting and tweeting, and they all have web pages. They're all on Facebook. It's quite interesting to watch that the trend develops and how mm-hmm. quickly it develops.
You mentioned the fact that they like to give responses to their hometown television, newspapers, etc. I've also heard that some of them get there very, very early so they can be on television shaking the president's hand. What's the story on that? Do they get there very, very early?
Yes. In fact, this is a trend that's been going on since the 1970s, that people will come hours before the speech to sit on the aisle. You know, bring a book and sit and read, and because that's their moment. They will be seen shaking hands with the president. And quite often it's the same people year after year that you see. That's their moment to shine. If you're in the House of Representatives, you're one of 435, and you can get lost in the sea. But there's that moment when every TV camera will be focusing on you shaking hands with the president of the United States. And then afterwards, in the Statuary Hall, which is just next to the House chamber, there'll be dozens of TV cameras set up, and members will literally sprint out the door to get back to talk to reporters from their regions along the way. In fact, there's a saying in the Capitol that the most dangerous place to be is between a member of Congress and a TV camera, and probably that's most true on the night of the State of the Union.
I would imagine. Thank you, Jake, for your call. We have a couple lines open in a couple more minutes with our guest, the historian for the United States Senate. Donald Ritchie is with us. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Tom in Grafton, hi.
Hi, good morning. I have a quick question for Mr. Ritchie. I was listening to the radio yesterday, and they were talking about three responses to the State of the Union. I guess one is from Rand Paul, the other is Marco Rubio, but I'm not sure who the third person was. And my question is, why or when did we go to having three responses as opposed to just one official response?
Well, I suppose that anybody who can possibly give a response would like to do that to draw attention to their issues. Whether or not anybody actually watches or pays attention to those responses is another issue. It's a very hard act to follow, and in fact, in many cases, the response to the State of the Union gets fairly highly criticized by the media, and in some cases, it's sort of pushed people to the back of the pack rather than bringing them to the forward. So it's a tricky proposition. Whether or not the secondary and third speeches or whatever will draw much attention is something to be seen. But each party is always experimenting with ways in which to get their message across.
Well, it is hard to sit still because it's a fairly lengthy address usually, and then you have somebody else giving an address, and you want to say, we're just not living in a century where people sat and listened to people talk for 2 hours.
Exactly. And then you also have the instant analysis in which the various commentators will spend some time saying, well, this is what the president just told you and all the rest of it. So for the real political junkies, you can spend a lot of time watching the State of the Union, the responses, the analysis, and all the rest of it. But I suspect for the larger public, they'll watch the State of the Union message, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. Russ in Superior is next. Hi, Russ. Hi, Russ. Are you there? Oh, Russ isn't there. The Senate historian gets a front row seat?
No, actually, the Senate historian watches it on television.
No. Oh, Donald, why don't you get a seat?
Well, because it's very crowded and everybody wants to get in there, and so I'm quite happy to watch it and to see it later on. We as Senate historians see a lot of the ceremony in the Capitol, but the State of the Union is one that we've not been to.
And tell me about your job. How does somebody become the Senate historian? It's rather an unusual position, isn't it?
Well, the office was created in 1975 in part because of the Watergate scandal, when the Senate and House were forcing the president to open up his records and to make presidential records public records.
Oh.
Historians turned around and said, well, what are you doing about your own records?
Oh.
So the Senate then created the Historical Office. It is now a House Historical Office. It's a bipartisan office, or a nonpartisan office. Senator Mike Mansfield and Senator Hugh Scott, who were the Democratic and Republican leaders, created the office. And we try to get the records of Congress open, and we also and preserved as well. And then we also answer questions that people have about issues that the Senate is dealing with. And we do an oral history program with retired senators and retired staff. And we have a lot of information on the Senate's website, which is www.senate.gov. We're the history portion of that. And lots of students turn to us, but many reporters call us on a daily basis to try to check their facts about what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm delighted that you could be with us on Today of All Days. Just tell us what happens in terms of physical preparation for tonight's address and security preparations. It must be immense.
Oh, well, they actually already had a dress rehearsal. They had one of the staff members come to the door, and the sergeant-at-arms said, Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States, and this staff member walked down the aisle and waved his hand and shook hands with people along the way. They do the little dress rehearsals to make sure that everything will work smoothly. But, of course, this is a ceremony that has been done year after year, and many of the staff up here are veterans of State of the Union messages, and they'll make sure that everything comes off perfectly. There was one glitch one year when President Clinton was giving his State of the Union message, discovered that his own staff had put the wrong speech on the prompter.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And turned around to Vice President Gore and said, it's the wrong speech. And Gore said, that's impossible. And President Clinton said, you're not the one giving the speech, I am. And so they had to hustle and bring around the staff with a laptop who was able to download the correct speech. Clinton winged it for about 7 minutes.
Unbelievable.
Until a lot of presidents would have been flabbergasted, I think, at that stage. There is always a possibility of some glitch happening.
Ooh, and some Senate staffer got chewed out for that
one. No, it was a White House staffer who did that one.
Ooh, how could you let that happen, right? That was a big snafu. Donald, thank you so much. It's been a delight to speak with you. Please join us again.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Donald Ritchie, the historian for the United States Senate, giving us a rundown of all of the State of the Union addresses, which the Constitution is not very specific about, just mandating that from time to time the president should give the Congress a series of recommendations. What's the president thinking about? What's the president's wish list? And the history, we're young, but we are old enough to have quite a history with this in terms of who talked and what they talked about and how the press handled it and when people started responding, etc. Tonight we will be carrying the State of the Union address here on the Ideas Network. It will be at 8 o'clock tonight, and it will be followed by the Republican response from Representative Marco Rubio. That's tonight at 8 here on the Ideas Network. We continue our conversation about the State of the Union because it is tonight, and Reed Epstein is our guest now, White House reporter for Politico. He's written an interesting piece, which you can find probably on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, 5 Things to Watch For in the State of the Union Address. Oh, you guys are going to be so prepared for tonight's viewing experience. This is great. Reed joined Politico from Newsday. He also worked at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, covering crime, local politics, and, as he says, people who break the Wisconsin butter law. He was also a New York correspondent for the Ottawa Citizen. He's interned at the Wall Street Journal. And perhaps most importantly, which is how you get a love for the business, he delivered his hometown Peoria, Illinois newspaper every morning for 4 years. Our phone number for Reed is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Reed. Thank you so much for being with us. Oh, we got him on this line. Hi, Reed. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah, we just talked to the Senate historian, so we know exactly how this day has been dealt with ever since George Washington. It was a fascinating conversation. Would you, as the historian said at one point, that it's kind of a wish list for the president tonight? This is what I would like to accomplish. And I guess in order to get people excited about it, you have to put your wish list together in a pretty compelling fashion.
Well, you know, you have to ask for everything you want and then hope that you get half of it or a little bit more than that. And that's sort of how these traditionally go. You know, the president will lay out what his agenda will be for the next year. And we'll sort of try to compel Congress to get behind it. He's sort of been doing that quite a bit since the election, especially on immigration and gun control, where he's trying to build a broad coalition to make some progress that he's not been able to get through for certainly during his first term.
That's one of the things that you highlight in your piece, Five Things to Watch. How far will he go on guns? Not whether or not he'll mention his gun push, but which part he will emphasize. Do you have any idea at this point which one he will emphasize?
Well, if you watch what the president and I was in Philadelphia yesterday with the vice president have been saying, they've really been pushing this idea that there is a broad consensus on universal background checks, which the gun advocates will tell the gun control advocates will tell you is the most important element of the president's broad gun control proposal. I think you're going to hear him say that members of Congress from both parties are coming together on this and sort of demand that they pass it with great haste. But you may not hear him talk so much about bans on assault weapons or high-capacity ammunition magazines because there's not a whole lot of bipartisan cooperation on those two issues, even though they're sort of the bigger, bolder type of headlines that came out of his gun control agenda when he announced it last month.
So he wouldn't mention that because he fears that won't get passed. It obviously is part of a big wish list for him that it goes way beyond universal background checks. But he's reading the crowd and thinking that I'm not going to get this through, so I'm not going to announce it?
Well, I mean, he's already announced it. It's not a question of whether it's something he's for. But, the sense is that he's going to come forward with a suggestion that he's building momentum in on background checks is certainly where the momentum is on guns at the moment, and there's a lot of members of his own party, Senate Democrats, that are leery about voting for any sort of strict prohibitions given their own electoral realities in a lot of these red states where Democrats hold Senate seats.
Mm-hmm. I know that he's going to have the Oak Creek police officer who was wounded in the horrible Sikh shooting last summer here in Milwaukee in the gallery. Do you know, will there be other people in the gallery, say, from Newton or other places of mass shootings?
Oh, certainly. In the First Lady's box will be the parents of the Chicago girl who marched in the inaugural and then was killed in a shooting in Chicago a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Former Congressman Gabrielle Giffords from Arizona will be in the gallery, as well as dozens of victims of gun violence and their families. There's been a broad push from members of Congress who are seeking gun control reforms to have the gallery filled with people who are had a personal experience and personal victims of gun crimes, to try to set that as as the stage almost like the White House Correspondents' Dinner is sort of the big party in the spring here where people bring famous guests. It's almost becoming like that. We've got a member of Congress from Texas who's bringing Ted Nugent, who's an outspoken opponent of any gun control reform, to be his guest in the gallery. And so we're certainly seeing a lot of members of Congress and certainly the president also trying to make a political point by who they have on their path list.
Oh, that's very interesting. You say that the first thing we should look for is the tone of the speech. Is it soft? Is it strident? Or is it somewhere in between? And let me preface, let me give you a couple questions here. How would you characterize the president for the first term? Would you say that he was soft, strident, or somewhere in between? And what do you expect in terms of the speech tonight in those categories?
Well, it's, sort of, it's really, you know, there's been an evolution with President Obama from someone who is out seeking bipartisan reforms and looking to cooperate with Republicans on things to someone who is looking for Republicans to cooperate with him and come across to his version of thinking. And that's really what we saw in the inaugural address when he introduced a much more progressive agenda than we'd ever seen from Obama in a single speech before. And I think you're going to see more of that tonight. He may couch some of it in this language of coalition building and consensus building, but it really will be on items and on issues that are near and dear to his heart and near and dear to Democrats' heart, as opposed to a suggestion that there's some sort of agreement meeting in the middle.
And why is it that we're hearing from him a more progressive agenda?
Well, in part because he and his White House, you know, have come to the realization and the conclusion that that the only way to win over Congress is to to go over their heads almost to the American people who he believes and the White House believes are with him. He certainly won the election, and their sense is that they have to really use a hammer to convince Republicans who wouldn't otherwise be with them on these issues to get the point across, that to win them to his agenda and to win votes in Congress, because they've learned in the first term, especially after the midterms, that that there's not a whole lot of common ground, in fact, especially on economic issues, and that think they do have to go to war with them, and that's what they've done before, and it seems that he's almost resigned to do it again.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome phone calls for you. We'll get to the other three things to watch in just a moment. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The president, of course, giving the State of the Union address this evening. And we are talking with Reed Epstein this half hour of the program. Wrote a piece in Politico. He works for Politico on five things to watch for in the State of the Union. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also send us a tweet. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Tuesday. 50 years ago, Betty Friedan started a national uproar about the role of women in society with her book, The Feminine Mystique. Today we'll be speaking with Stephanie Coons, who has written A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1950s. She's a very well-known social historian. Should be a fascinating conversation as we go through the decades and the generations and talk about the role of women and the role of men and the role of work and pay and all of that. All right, let's go to phone calls for Reed. Richard in Fort Atkinson, hi.
Hi. Of course, the State of the Union speech this evening from President Obama will be mostly aspirational and full of noble sentiments which have no possibility of enactment, while at the same time, President Bush and President Obama, together with the Congress, have destroyed our constitutional democracy, the First, the Fourth, the Fifth, the 14th Amendments to the Constitution are all gone through the agency of enactments like the Patriot Act and the National Defense Authorization Act. Meanwhile, he has a secret murder drone program, which has no legal sanction at all. It's a sad day for the United States, and Obama is chiefly responsible. Thank you.
I doubt he'll talk about the drone program tonight. What do you think, Reed?
Well, perhaps not the drone program in particular, but we learned in the last hour that he's going to announce that 34,000 troops will be home from Afghanistan by this time next year, cutting in half the U.S. troop footprint there. He'd said during the campaign in September that all the troops would be home from Afghanistan by the end of 2014, but he's quickly walked that back, suggesting he's gotten a little bit ahead of himself. But, you know, I think we're not going to hear a whole lot about the drone program in particular, especially since much of it has, the government still has not officially acknowledged exists. So I don't think we'll hear him talk too much about it during the State of the Union tonight.
Will we hear, other than Afghanistan, will he talk about his upcoming trip to the Middle East? Will he outline other foreign policy proposals?
Well, one thing that that will be really interesting to see is how much they write into the speech about North Korea last night.
Oh, yes.
Testing a nuclear bomb, whether that's something that he inserts some language at the last minute, issuing a response from the United States and really from the Western world. The president put out a statement at 2 in the morning condemning it, but certainly would get a lot more oxygen if it's something that he included as part of the State of the Union address.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Jobs for a moment. He has used the phrase, and I would imagine he will tonight, a big deal. Do you anticipate any kind of big, and I'm not sure what form it would take, Jobs creation announcement tonight?
What he's going to do is and what the White House has said, is that he'll push for his middle class agenda. That's sort of as a broad definition at this point. But he has said that any sort of tax reform deal, which to some people is a jobs deal also, would have to include more revenues, closing tax loopholes, et cetera, not necessarily raising tax rates like they did for the fiscal cliff deal. A jobs bill would translate it to stimulus funding would not be too terribly popular. Republicans are still smarting from the deal in 2009, nearly $800 billion stimulus package that created a lot of jobs during the recession. It's not necessarily not too likely that Republicans would allow something like that to pass again, but that wouldn't stop the president from announcing it or announcing that he'd like to do it.
Uh-huh. We were talking about the response to the State of the Union, and historically it's not that old, actually. This wasn't done in history, but it will be tonight by Marco Rubio, Congressman Rubio. I'm wondering if people listen to that, because the other thing is so long.
Well, tonight is going to be much more interesting than these responses have been in the past. Typically, they've been underwhelming. I remember Bobby Jindal, Louisiana governor, gave one a few years ago where it looked like he was
not well received. Yeah.
Sort of on the speech wasn't terribly good. The setting wasn't terribly good. Most years these responses, whether they're Democratic or Republican responses, have less than meets the eye. But tonight may be different, in part because Rubio is such a gifted speaker, and mm-hmm. two, really the road for immigration reform, which is one of the president's signature policy proposals in the second term, really is going to require Rubio's cooperation in the Senate. And so you have, the president may, in his speech, tout the cooperation from Rubio already. He's part of a group of eight senators that have put forth a bipartisan Senate framework for immigration reform. You could have the possibility of the president name-checking Rubio as someone who's cooperating on immigration reform just moments before Rubio himself comes on to rebut the president's speech. Sets up a dynamic that we've really never had before in these speeches, where the president and the person responding to him are working together on a particular signature piece of legislation at the same time they're speaking in opposition to each other on the night of the State of the Union.
Right. And how was Senator Rubio chosen? That obviously the decision must be made with great thought.
Yeah, the response speaker is chosen by Speaker John Boehner and the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Between the two of them, they agree on someone to give the response. And it's typically someone who is someone who can carry the Republican message as well. Oftentimes it's someone who's perceived as a rising star in the party. That's certainly the case
mm-hmm.
with Rubio this year.
Yeah. Let's go to Ellen in Milwaukee. Hi, Ellen. Ellen, are you there? Ellen is not there. She wanted to comment, though, and we talked about this a little bit, the time when President Clinton had the wrong speech put in the teleprompter. I would imagine that after that happened, that is never going to happen again, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, Clinton had the teleprompters went out or the wrong speech loaded, and he was able to ad lib half the speech before they got it right. And most people watching at home didn't really notice. It really spoke to sort of what a gifted extemporaneous speaker he was. And he did it again when he spoke at the Democratic convention in Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
They released prepared remarks for what he would say, and his speech was about twice as long as the prepared remarks because he went off on his own ad libs that almost more than he stuck to the script during the speech.
He can talk, can he?
Yeah, he's that it was one thing that worried the Obama's team during the convention was what would the president say? What would President Clinton say? Because they had a speech that he had worked on and they'd signed off on, but once you're in front of the microphone and you start talking, there's no real good way to get you to stop.
Right. Our phone number, if you care to join us, is 800-486-8655, and we have some lines open for you right now. We're getting a preview of what we ought to look at tonight. Our guest has written an interesting piece in Politico. Reed Epstein is White House reporter for Politico. He worked at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel for a while, too. And so we're talking about what the five things are that we ought to key into. And one of them that we have not talked about yet is, what's the hashtag?
Well, that's right. These speeches tend to have a theme around them each year, some sort of catchy slogan. And now in the age of Twitter and Facebook, you have to have it short enough that it can fit into fit into a single tweet that people can share. And so in the past, we've heard him say things like winning the future or I won't quit. And one thing that the president and Joe Biden have been saying a lot, especially around gun control and immigration, is now is the time. And so that's one thing that to watch out for, him repeating a line like that or any sort of short pithy phrase over and over again to try to build sort of a thematic grouping around the rest of the speech.
When was it in the State of the Union that George W. Bush talked about using his capital, that elections had consequences, he knew he was going to use his capital? Was that State of the Union?
It wasn't in the State of the Union. That was in a press conference shortly after his 2004 reelection campaign. But he's certainly, presidents have used the State of the Union to sort of mention pet projects. One thing President that people don't always remember about President Bush was he used the State of the Union to condemn the use of steroids in professional sports and baseball long before it was such a hot-button issue like it is now. And he was mocked a little bit for that at the time as bringing up an issue that wasn't necessarily serious, but it did spur some of the action that we've seen now, or at least some of the folks in sports believe it did. And so the president can use this speech to put China spotlight on particular issues that they're interested in or that they'd like to see the country move forward on.
Can you think of anything that President Obama may mention tonight that we hadn't thought of?
I think that he's more likely to, stick to his narrow set of proposals. I don't think you'll see him bring things out of left field. He mentioned in an interview with the New Republic that was printed a couple weeks ago that he was concerned about safety in professional football.
Yes.
That's sort of something that he was able to force a discussion on for about a week ahead of the Super Bowl, but I don't think it's something that you're going to see him that's going to rise to the level of being included in the State of the Union speech.
Mm. Do you think we'll see action on that, though, in Congress in the next year?
I think Congress is pretty busy with a lot of other things
right at
the moment. It's sort of hard to fathom how they could justify spending time on injuries in professional football
right
when they haven't got done immigration or gun control or a budget or much of anything else.
Reed, when will you get a copy of the speech?
The White House has a briefing this afternoon where they'll tell reporters, give reporters a run through of what's going to be in the speech. The copies will come out usually about an hour or a half hour beforehand, and then almost all of that information is embargoed until the president begins speaking. So you may have a copy of the speech, but you're not able to report on it until it begins.
I see. Thank you so much for being with us. Enjoy the conversation.
Thank you. Anytime.
Reed Epstein, White House reporter for Politico, and he has a column today or a news piece, Five Things to Watch For in the State of the Union. Our thanks also to the historian of the Senate who joined us the first half hour, Donald Ritchie. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Katie Mattson for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio and an interesting conversation ahead. Do you know it's been 50 years since Betty Friedan wrote The Feminine Mystique? So we'll talk about, this is a huge topic but fascinating, what's happened to the role of women since she wrote that book?